Hello there, welcome to the Tech Means Business podcast. This is a series of podcasts where we talk to interesting people in business or in technology, or preferably where those two particular fields of life come together. We've covered a massive range of subjects over the course of these two series of podcasts, but one we keep returning to time and time again, probably because it's so absolutely vital, critical to many, many businesses, and that's cybersecurity. So today we're not talking about Kubernetes or cryptocurrency or anything really like that. We're focusing on cybersecurity, and I'm joined by Dave Lewis of Duo Security, a company that was acquired a while back by Cisco Systems. And Dave will have to cover off that particular acquisition maybe in a little bit more detail later on. But for now, welcome Dave of Duo Security. Welcome to the Tech Means Business podcast. And as has become tradition, we always leave our guests initially at least to give us a bit of a brief introduction to yourself and your career and, in this case, how you ended up at Duo Security.
Thank you very much for having me on. My name is Dave Lewis, as you mentioned, a global advisory CISO for Cisco Systems. And I came into this role as a part of the acquisition of Duo Security, which Cisco bought in about 3 years ago now, which is actually kind of amazing. Myself, I have been in security one form or another probably close to 30 years now. And bit daunting when I think about it that way. But along the road there, I've had the benefit of being in basically every role you could imagine, from, you know, being a firewall admin right through to being a CISO for a company. And it has been quite an interesting adventure, to say the very least.
I think 30 years ago, cybersecurity as a career probably didn't exist. So, you know, did you start out maybe as a sysadmin, or were you on a help desk? Where did you begin? Where did you first make your bones, as it were?
Well, I actually started things out in networking. Well, truth be told, I started as a rapid application developer for a bank, and that lasted roughly 10 days. And I discovered that there was a firewall team at the bank that had one person, and this was a company that had 55,000 employees. So I saw quite the opportunity. So I got in my boss's face about, you know, joining that team, because prior to my joining the company, I had actually developed quite an affinity for hacking. While I was at school, one of the interesting things was it was a team-based approach at this school, this postgraduate stuff. And I found that I could hack into the other team projects while they were working on it, and just for giggles. And it just really sparked an interest in me that is really still going today. So it was really just out of that innate curiosity, and just honestly being in the right place at the right time really took off for me, because while I did a lot of networking, while I did the rapid application development back in the day, it was never truly my love. It was just, it was something that did interest me. But when I saw that opportunity and I was able to capitalize on it, it really grew from there. And later on, you know, doing the same sort of role for Department of Defense in the United States as a contractor, you know, FBI, various banks, power companies. It really, each individual experience has helped me grow, both personally and professionally.
You've mentioned banks there a couple of times in various contexts, and it brings up something that came up in our pre-show chat, and that's about legacy code, legacy stack, and security debt. And the reason why I mentioned banks there is because I happen to know that here in the UK, for instance, quite a lot of the banking stack, as it were, still runs on COBOL, which is a language that must be 30, if not 40 years old. So can you define for us, Dave, please, this concept of security debt?
So in my way of looking at things, security debt is about a technological debt that's manifested as a security issue, either by virtue of time or interaction with other systems, different inputs, whatever it happens to be, something that causes an issue that may not have been seen as being a security problem when the technical debt was, you know, identified. But a lot of organizations, they'll just say, yes, we know that it's an old system, but it's okay because it's behind a firewall or something like that, which is, you know, unfortunately broken logic, because these issues do have a way of coming back to haunt us. A great example of this was the Heartbleed issue. And for those of you who don't know, there was a code flaw either put in by malice or happenstance. We'll never really be sure of that end game there, where the SSL libraries that were used by basically every e-commerce site on the planet had the ability for an external attacker to gain access to their systems and purloin data. This was a problem that was in the code for about 2 years. This was a library that was maintained by exactly two people and only one of them full time. So it's these sort of exposures that we see cropping up, you know, waiting to use your example of having these COBOL programmers that can come back and fix these systems. Yes, great lucrative business for them, but this is not a sustainable model. We have to look at ways that we can have an iterative process of, you know, either doing an entire tech refresh on the networking, on the servers, whatever it happens to be. We have to make sure that we're rolling out code that is, you know, nimble, agile, and can, you know, stand the test of time. A lot of times in the past, we would have project-based approaches to things and never a outcome-based approach. So organizations would spin up these projects to satisfy a particular need at that time. Unfortunately, there was no plan for what was going to come next. You know, the planned obsolescence was baked into it because there was no future-looking way to approach these systems and make sure that they were going to stand the test of time, or conversely, have a sunset provision built into them so that we don't get stuck with these systems that have been running for 30-plus years, much like myself.
Interesting subject ahoy there. You mentioned that there was was it in OpenSSL that the Heartbleed bug was found? Yeah, it brings up the whole issue, doesn't it, of open source software versus proprietary code, especially in the security sector. Now, obviously, you work for a company that charges money for its services, but a great deal, of course, of the security stack is still built and remains on open source libraries, open source code. Is that something that you see continuing and expanding?
I absolutely hope so. I think that it is an integral part of everything we do. And to, you know, go with the analogy of welding the hood shut on your car, it really only serves a very small number of people. So having the ability and the capacity to look at the code yourselves and review it, hopefully problems like we saw with Heartbleed will not be as prevalent as they were at one point. Obviously, there are going to be issues as we go along, but I believe that open source code absolutely has a place in the ecosystem. And I think that, you know, it will continue to go. But the problem is we have to make sure that, you know, for-profit companies that are using this code are, you know, ponying up where it's using it. So if you're using an open source library in your software and an issue crops up like this, did you do anything to help contribute to maintaining that library? Did you do anything to make sure that these issues were being reviewed prior to them becoming widely known? You know, it is definitely a system where we have to make sure that we are contributing back to the open source community in order to foster this, because, you know, this groupthink approach of open source software is absolutely fantastic, because we've seen some very novel solutions that have come out. And I believe that we'll see a lot more as things go on, because, you know, when I grew up, we had cave paintings and wonderful things like that. And my kids are born into a world where it's digital first, right? They don't know what it's like to hear the screech of a modem when it's dialing up. They heard it on a TV show the other day and they said, "What is that noise? It's so annoying." And I'm sitting there sweating in the corner having flashbacks. So I believe that, you know, the kids today are going to have far more ingenious solutions that are going to come out, because this is the world they're born into. You know, we are part of a generation that built this world in a digital sense. And I believe that, you know what, they are going to really show us some amazing things in the future.
So can we talk now, Dave, about passwordless? It's a bit of a buzz phrase in security at the moment, passwordless authentication. Now, obviously, wherever I go, I use the same password. But what I do, I'm very cunning. I change the letter A into a 4, which, of course, no one will ever guess. But if we ditch all passwords altogether, how does that work? You know, how do we authenticate into these systems that we use daily?
Okay, so we have to be a little bit clear here. We're not actually getting rid of passwords per se. It's being handled in an automated fashion. So the end user, who may be very good in finance or HR or whatever it happens to be in procurement, has no capacity or interest in focusing on, you know, security tools written by engineers for engineers. They just want to get their job done. They want to focus on their core competencies. So we have to be able to give them tools to be able to do that. And passwordless is a way forward, which is going to make it easier for users. Like, we've been stuck with passwords since, I think, 1962, when MIT rolled them out as a knee-jerk reaction to a problem. So it was a tactical approach. It was never meant to be a strategic approach. It was never meant to be the way forward as a security control, because it has the same efficacy as a house key. Right? When you lock your flat and you go out for the day, if you had kids and you stick them under your doormat because they're going to get home earlier than you are, then you're thinking, oh, okay, that's fine. They'll be, but criminals know this as well. So they'll look under the doormat. They'll look in the little plastic rock in the garden. They'll look in the mailbox and they'll say, okay, oh, there's the key, and get in. It does not mean that they're supposed to be there, but by virtue of the fact they have the key, they can get in. This is where stuff like multi-factor authentication, biometrics, and passwordless will rely on those other features like your fingerprint or whatever it happens to be, retina scan or facial scan, in order to ensure that that is in fact the person who's supposed to be there. So passwordless is where you authenticate. So if you have your mobile device and you use your thumbprint to get in, as an example, then that credential, which is stored in a secure enclave on the device, is then used to authenticate yourself into the systems that you need in order to get your work done or your daily life, however you have it set up. There's an open standard that was put out by W3C called WebAuthn, and I want to really emphasize that into open standard. That is going to be a really great, well, it is not going to be, it is a great step forward for getting to passwordless. So when you authenticate to your device and then you are able to get into any of your web-based offerings, you know, email, Salesforce, whatever it happens to be, in order to get your job done. So this handles the credentials, handles the authentication to these services, transparent to the user. So you're democratizing security by making it easier for those users to get things done in a safe and secure manner without having to worry about password 2, password 3, password 4, and so on, or the number 4 in your password. Because that really, you know, the attackers know this. They know how to, you know, look for these sort of things. And by virtue of that as well, we have to understand that humans, we have a bad habit of reusing the same passwords because, you know, I myself have in my password vault have over 1,000 different sets of credentials, which is kind of maddening when you think about it. So the average user, even if it's at 200 sets of credentials, is never going to remember that as a way of going forward. So we have to be able to give them better mechanisms, either multi-factor authentication, biometrics, you know, thumbprint, facial scans, whatever it's going to be, in order to streamline that process and make it as easy as possible for them to get their work done safely and securely.
Now, eagle-eyed listeners there will have noticed that Dave said the word E there, E for easy. And of course, that's why, you know, people do leave their keys under their doormats, or copies of their passwords stuck on a post-it note on their monitors, or even worse, you know, on a piece of paper that's been tacked neatly in the middle of the staff notice board, which is a thing I've seen before. Now, the reason why people do that is because it's easy. That's the capital E word again. And you mentioned democratization there, Dave. And is that kind of a balancing act? We've got to make access easy, and yet somehow we've got to make it more secure. That's actually quite an interesting little dichotomy, isn't it, for security experts to solve?
It really is, and this really gets down to the user experience, right? So if you are giving them a tool that requires them to jump through multiple hoops to get something done, they're going to find a way around it. They are going to really go out of their way to, you know, this is why we end up with skunkworks projects and things of that effect, where they're spun up within a business in order for them to get jobs done. You know, these sort of projects don't get spun up out of a sense of malice. It's like they see limiting factors and they're trying to avoid these limiting factors so they can get things done. So as security practitioners, as IT organizations, have to really embrace that, not as a negative, but as a, okay, what did we miss? What is it that we are not doing as an organization to facilitate their ability to get their jobs done? So if you are doing something like passwords, as an example, if you can just rely on a thumbprint on a device that's already enrolled to authenticate you to your applications, as an example, you've then streamlined it for the user. They don't need to know how it works. They just have to know that it is done in a safe and secure fashion. Because most people won't really take security seriously until something negative happens. And that's an unfortunate reality. If an attacker finds the key under the doormat and they're able to get into your flat, this is going to have a deep and visceral effect on you when you get home and find out that everything that you care about has been cleaned out of the house. But until that point, usually folks won't really embrace security because that's not what they think about on a daily basis. Sure, they make sure they're, you know, looking both ways before they cross the street, but they don't really understand and embrace what happens until they have an unfortunate situation where they're lying on the hood of a car.
If I can swing the subject round now, Dave, to paraphrase the advert, the future, capital T, capital F, it's a bit of a acronym soup, I guess, really. Big acronyms at the moment, especially in cybersecurity, are AI stroke ML. And there's a tendency, isn't there, to get the artificial intelligence come machine learning sticker and slap it on everything because it sells a few more units. Do you think, or are you convinced, by claims of machine learning being effective in cybersecurity? Do you think it's going to be a catch-all? Is it a brave new world? Does it have its uses? Or, as we might say in the UK, it's, such claims are a load of all...
honestly, it's an if-then-else statement. We have to frame it correctly, right? I believe that, yes, it is another tool that we can use to improve things. Automation will definitely relieve a lot of the pain and suffering that security teams have. But it is not magical pixie dust that we get to sprinkle on everything and everything's going to be magically all right. We went through the same sort of acronym soup or the, you know, buzzwords of cloud back, you know, quite a few years ago, where I remember I was at one conference walking around. I saw this one vendor that was selling an appliance and I said, you know, what is the cloud part of your solution? And after talking for about 5 minutes, finally, he lamented, he's like, no, there's actually nothing about cloud that's associated with our product. We just said it so we could sell. I was like, okay, that's a little bit disconcerting. So making sure that you frame this in the right context and understand it's a hammer. It just might be, you know, blue or green, whatever color the hammer is. It's a different tool in order to get to end of job. And if you are able to alleviate some of the pressures on your security team so they can focus on other projects, other outcomes that they need to do for their organization, then it's a win. You know, I just finished a class at MIT just a few months ago on AI and ML. And while it's absolutely fascinating, we are not at a point where we can just, you know, say it's a dystopian future. Everything's going to be this. It is absolutely just a new tool for the tool set. And, you know, the attackers will use the same tools as we're going to use. So it's just, you know, just one more piece of the puzzle in order for us to help or build our security programs and don't get lost in the mystique of it is definitely my guiding principle.
Now, Cisco's a smart company. It employs smart people. And so it says smart things. And it's clever enough, therefore, not to say, buy our platform and you will be 100% safe, because anyone who knows certain parts of the body from other parts of the body knows that simply isn't true. But as far as you're concerned, in the medium to long term, therefore, are companies and organizations still going to be having to use lots of different tools to protect themselves? Or is there ever going to be room for a meta package? Apologies there for the use of the word meta. In technology circles, but is there ever going to be, you know, a large overreaching package, if you like, one tool to rule them all?
I don't believe so, because, you know, you're going to have different outcomes that organizations need to achieve, right? So they're going to have different requirements, and not all tools are going to be the right tools for that particular organization based on their requirements. So vendors such as ourselves, we have a fantastic suite of tools that we can help, you know, provide that service to organizations, but it has to be driven by those organizations, those customers, to say, we need this to satisfy these requirements so we can achieve these outcomes, right? We can't just be in the vendor space dictating to them what they need in order to get things done. They have to come to us as to what the solutions are they're trying to provide. And as vendors, we need to be that trusted partner to work with them to get to that long-term goal. Because as we're moving more and more towards cloud-based offerings, SaaS-based offerings, we're really getting into relationship building. So the idea in the past of, you know, having vendors that would get your PO, drop the box on your loading dock, and you'd never see them again, and I have experienced that years ago. It was not fun. That does nothing to improve you know, your disposition towards each other, and it becomes like an adversarial nature. And we have to really work on building that trust. You know, trust is a fundamental element that we have to take into account. You know, we're born into this world defaulting to trust. We need that in order to survive, get food, get shelter. But in a cybersecurity world, that doesn't translate. So we have to be able to build that trust and understand that it's transient. We have to make sure that we're constantly re-verifying. So if it is building a relationship, we have to build that on trust. If it's authenticating somebody to a system, we have to establish that trust, and so on and so forth, right? So this trust has to be constantly iterated through. And I think that we are going to get to a better place in the long term, getting away from the, you know, buy a box and that's the last time we ever see you, and more towards that relationship paradigm.
Yes, I remember those days as well of the box landing on the loading bay, which would be your cybersecurity solution. Those boxes would often be red, actually, when you plug them in, as I recall. I did a podcast in the first series of the Tech Means Business podcast where we talked about developing trust between machines, and it sounds, you know, Isaac Asimov-y, doesn't it? You know, trust between robots and the like. But actually, now so many things are controlled by machines, and there's so much machine-to-machine traffic, depending on who you talk to. You know, you're looking at, what, 60, 70% of internet traffic these days comprises API calls. There's actually a great deal more to security, whichever way you look at it, than the pure human element, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's just it. The automation is definitely a factor that we're seeing built out across the board, not just in security. And we have to make sure that we're able to authenticate these systems, because you're looking at, you know, protecting the workplace, the workforce, and the workload, and each individual piece of the business will fall into one of those buckets. So if we're able to establish trust between devices, you know, it'd be the, you know, an API call that is authenticated, you're really reducing the risk. So imagine you had vehicles that were networked, and you pushed out a firmware update to the vehicles, but it wasn't signed. Theoretically, an attacker could then push out a firmware package that had malicious code built into it, and they know that, oh, the system's just going to accept it because it's coming in as a file named X. That's just one example. High-end trading, you know, these systems have to be so fast. It's absolutely stunning how quickly they are processing transactions. If they are not trusted between each other, and if there is the ability for a third party to interject, the cascade failure to the markets could be absolutely staggering. So yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely an element that we have to figure out a good way to do it. I mean, there are lots of ways that we can do it through authentication mechanisms that are available today and, you know, coming in the future. But we also have to look at the ideas of how is the data protected. We have the ability to, you know, protect data in flight, at rest, but homomorphic encryption hasn't gotten to the point where it is something that we can utilize across the board. We are seeing it, like there's the CryptDB project from MIT is a great example, where you can search the database, but all the data is encrypted. So you're able to do really amazing things from that regard. That is an interesting technology that we're seeing come up more and more, but it hasn't gotten to the point where it is ready for wide adoption. So we have to make sure that we have controls in place to protect the data when it's being processed. And again, that's a trust issue as well. So you have zone segmentation to protect it. You have, you know, multi-factor authentication for the humans to make sure that they are not accessing stuff they're not allowed to get to. Because, you know, we look back at, you know, some of the earliest data breaches we had with AOL as an example back in, I think it was 2004, where 92 million records were compromised by a user that, or by a staffer who decided to try and sell them. I think he actually did sell them. But that's just one example of where that was something that could have been prevented with the proper controls in place at the time. And unfortunately, that trust was violated. So we have to make sure that we're constantly looking at trust as something that has to be renewed in a continuous basis. And is not just granted as, you know, when we're born into this world, like Malcolm Gladwell talked about this in his book, Talking to Strangers, about how to communicate with each other as we go through life. But when we're starting out defaulting to trust, it is hard for us to get a solid concept of establishing trust in the future in a way that makes sense, that is going to protect ourselves as well. So it's a really interesting ball of yarn once you start pulling on it on how we can establish that.
Yeah, trust is definitely worth reiterating here. If you think back to the SolarWinds attack, was it, where it was actually signed code updates, which have been signed by, you know, the correct key pairs and the like. And it was actually those updates or patches, security updates, that were being pushed out to security systems. And they were trusted, of course. And we all know what happened with SolarWinds. The keys themselves had been compromised.
Yes. And so this was a problem that affected a lot of organizations. And it's unfortunate, but this is something that has been discussed for quite a few years. I mean, I gave my first talk on supply chain security back in 2014 when I was in Dublin. And it was amazing how that seemed like a novel concept at the time. And now it is front of mind for everyone because, you know, the attackers are going to come at you in new and exciting ways. If you put up all the firewalls, all the MFA, all the rest of it to protect your organization, they'll find something new. This is gone from, you know, back in the day, it was compromising websites and putting it on defacement mirrors like Aldous, Zone H, attrition.org. This was the thing at the time, but there was no monetary incentive there. It was all about getting street cred for the different hacker groups. Nowadays, it is a huge industry. I won't associate a number with it as to how much, because that's anybody's guess, and I'm not going to go onto the hyperbole there. But it really is, it's big business, and there is a lot of money on the table.
So it's been absolutely marvelous. Thanks ever so much, Dave, for joining us. The music's coming up, so we're obviously reaching the end of our time. So again, thanks for joining us on the Tech Means Business podcast, Dave. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you all as well, dear listeners, for joining us on this deep dive into cybersecurity with Dave Lewis of Duo Security, or late of Duo Security, Cisco Systems. Anyway, we never really got to the bottom of that, did we? Links in the show notes, as ever, to delve into more information about what the two of us have been talking about today. And I hope that you can join me next time on the Tech Means Business podcast. Bye for now.